Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello. You go first.
After you, Cecil. After you.
I'm looking at you blankly. This is going over my head.
After you, Cecil. After you, Claude. For some reason, it's what my dad used to say, and I have literally no idea where it comes from.
Have you ever Googled it?
No, I'm about to do so.
I love the lack of curiosity that you've got through your whole life until this point.
What was I'd never thought of it until this moment. Here we go. Yeah, Itmar was a BBC Radio 4 thing.
Oh, it's that man again.
Yeah, it was abbreviated to Itmar. Well, it was a BBC radio series from 1939 to 1949. My dad came over, as you know, in 1940. And he was in the Royal Navy during the war, and he must have listened to it after the war.
Wow. Because those radio programs were so popular because there were only one or two channels and pretty much no TV, so everybody listened to them.
Those were the days of, was it the Home Service?
And the light program, was that a thing?
We're in serious danger of nostalgia here, aren't we?
I don't know what nostalgia for something from before you were even born is called.
I don't know.
Maybe being a conservative, I don't know.
Wartime comedy series starring Tommy Handley, which spawned many of the catchphrases popular all over the country. It was about Hitler. Oh, no, one was Hitler. The other man was Liverpudlian comedian Tommy Handley.
I'm pretty sure Hitler wasn't in a double act with Tommy Handley. I think your information is wrong there.
You're right about that.
Let's have a look. I'm on Wikipedia now looking for some of the catchphrases. Oh, TTFN.
TTFN. Ta-ta for now.
Ta-ta for now, yeah. Boss, something terrible's happened.
I've never heard that.
Don't forget the diver. I'll have to ask me dad. Lovely grub. It's me knives.
This is so interesting. On the 6th of January 1949, ITMA broadcast what was to be its final episode. 3 days after the episode was broadcast, Handley suffered a cerebral hemorrhage and died. And then on the day of the funeral, mourners and sightseers lined the six-mile route between the private chapel at Westbourne Grove and the Golders Green Crematorium.
Wow.
Two memorial services were held, one at St. Paul's Cathedral and the other at Liverpool's Cathedral. Sadly, only a few episodes of Itmar still exist.
Oh, listen to this. Listen to this. Ready? There's a catchphrase from Itmar that we could adopt.
Go
because
on.
I'm sure if it finished in, did you say 1950?
Yeah.
I'm sure it's fallen
49.
Out. 49. It must have fallen out of copyright. Listen to this. It's been so cheerful, that keeps me going.
Ah, now listen to this. The most iconic character to come out of this series was Mrs. Mop, whose catchphrase, "Can I do you now, sir?" quickly became one of the... you've heard that phrase, haven't you?
I have, but I'm sort of reeling from the fact that you seem completely unimpressed by the fact that there was a catchphrase on that show, which was, "It's being so cheerful, that keeps me going."
Sorry. I was just interested in my own research. I'm just going to get a tissue. Just one sec.
I really love it when people refer to their own research And basically, they mean looking at Wikipedia.
You see, it's interesting because my dad was obviously not born in Britain, and yet he took on these quite British... You know what I mean? It's obviously, I don't know quite what the humour was on It's That Man Again, but...
Don't you think that's a real sort of immigrant mentality?
Yeah,
you sort of throw yourself into a culture.
Possibly. That might be right. But I've said to you before, haven't I, that he was called Adolf, my dad.
I don't know if you have ever told me that.
Yeah, he was called Adolf. But he arrived in Britain and his landlady, this is like he's come off the boat, he's just arrived here, and his landlady says... Can't be having this. We can't be having you called Adolf. You're going to have to be called Ralph from now on.
Wow. You've never told me that. That's incredible. What year was he born?
1924. And he always used to say that his mother had a sort of flyer fancy that Adolf was a good name with a PH, I think.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that was much of a defence, really.
No, I think it would be stranger meeting somebody called Adolf from the second half of the 20th century.
It was a good move by the landlady, though.
Mm. I would have maybe gone with Rudolph.
No, I think Ralph was quite good.
Yeah. Now, we're not in the same room. Ed is talking to me remotely. You were due to come here,
but
terrible misfortune befell you.
Are you going to sort of expose me again?
No, I'm offering sympathy, and hopefully you'll get some sympathy from the listener as well.
No, but I could be sort of Itmar, couldn't I, really, for these purposes?
It's that man again. Because you fell off your bike again.
I know. And it wasn't a dog this time. I mean, do you remember the dog incident?
We do.
The dog in the daytime. The curious incident of the dog in the daytime.
So are you all right?
Yeah, I've got a little bit of a bad rib.
Oh.
It was just on the road, really. It was quite slippy and it was very wet. And I just... went for a Burton, basically.
Poor thing.
It was my stupidity rather than anything else.
I don't think anybody thought it was anything else.
No, quite fine, good.
But when we first were discussing the idea of you cycling on the podcast, you were toying initially with the idea of a tricycle rather than a bicycle.
Yeah, I should go back to that.
Well, I just think it maybe the three wheels might have given you more stability.
I know, but I wouldn't have been able to get around. I mean, look, honestly, I am a total convert now. It was not a serious accident. I want to sort of underline.
I think I know what I'm getting you for Christmas / your birthday.
What?
Stabilisers.
The trouble is, I think it would be make it too wide. I'm so glad I didn't get the tricycle.
Would you consider, like, I've been thinking of a safer way for you to get around the city whilst not having...
Tandem?
What about zorbing?
What's that?
Like being in a big hamster ball. I think you'd be safe from the elements.
Can you? But what about the scooters? I mean, they are also... I mean, people speeding past you on scooters, that is quite scary.
Not for you.
No. But it's just also quite scary for if it's not you.
Mm. Shall we talk about what we're talking about this week then?
Yes.
Well, this week we're talking about the history and future of disability activism. We're going to be chatting to disability justice activist and research fellow at UCL, Anna Landra, to Swiss author Christoph Keller about his new book, Every Cripple a Superhero, and finally to community co-curator Ruth Mulkin about a new exhibition at the People's History Museum in Manchester, Nothing About Us Without Us. So, what's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, I want to keep you updated on my swimming challenge, which, as you'll recall, is to swim in the ponds without the gloves and the socks.
You're still doing it?
Yep. I mean, I want to emphasise I'm wearing swimming trunks and a hat.
So what is the next thing to go? Is it the hat or the trunks?
Definitely the hat. I am a bit worried that the bike spill is going to constrain my swimming. And if I stop going for a bit, it will become much harder.
What if I just got you a Lilo so that you're still acclimatised to the water temperature as it gets colder as the...
No, cold showers are the answer. But you know what's very interesting is that there's a shower there, which is cold, but it's obviously hotter than the water temperature. So actually, I found this cold shower is quite a good antidote.
Have you measured that with your zapper?
No, the zapper's been slightly out of action.
Mm.
Please tell me your reason to be cheerful.
My reason to be cheerful is after almost 23, 24 years of living in London, I did one of the great touristy things that I've never done before.
Let me guess. Changing of the guard.
Nope.
Tower of London.
Nope.
Am I close? That. Am I warm?
Geographically, you're not that far from the Tower of London.
You went to the top of Post Office Tower.
No, you're not allowed since Thatcher privatised it.
Really?
I think so. Didn't there used to be a revolving restaurant up there? Although I don't know if I'd like to be in a revolving restaurant. I think I'd get a bit bilious.
Right, okay. Yeah, sorry. You're going to have to tell me then.
Went to the top of the monument.
Go on.
It looks, it's taller than Nelson's Column, actually, but it looks like that. But instead of a statue on top, it's a monument to the Great Fire of London. It was built a few years afterwards. And if you were to lay it flat, it would extend to where the fire started.
Wow.
We did it because Gene's been doing Great Fire of London at school and he was really keen to go. 311 stairs up a very narrow, windy staircase.
Oh, my Lord. Did you go up all the way?
Yeah.
Was he exhausted?
He was fine. I am quite scared of heights, but he wanted to do it. And so the reason I did it was I just want to give him a wonderful childhood. But I am slightly worried that I traumatized him because once we got to the top, I started all borderline hyperventilating and having to press myself up against the wall.
What did he say, Daddy, don't be scared?
Well, I was trying to conceal how scared I was from him because I didn't want him to catch it. So he was having a great time and I threw cold sweat, increased heart rate, shallow breathing, was going, oh, isn't this great? Look at the views. There's St. Paul's Cathedral.
This reminds me of the sort of, was it water skiing that you
parasailing.
Did
it was very similar, yeah. I'm not sure how brave my brave face is, though.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
To start the conversation, we are joined by disability justice activist and research fellow at UCL, Anna Landra. Hello.
Hi, nice to meet you guys.
You are currently working on a PhD about fixing the gap between what disability and access laws say and then the way that plays out in the real world. And that ties in with this idea of a social model of disability, that many disabilities wouldn't be disabling if the world that we live in wasn't set up by and for non-disabled people. So I wonder if we could start by introducing that as an idea, and if you could give us a couple of examples of how that plays out that non-disabled people might not have thought about.
Absolutely. So the classic example is that I, as a wheelchair user, have a lot of trouble getting around the world as it is constructed. And you can look at this two ways. You can look at it through the lens of what we call the medical model, which is that there's something wrong with my body, that my body has to be fixed or cured or healed some way so that I can walk. Or you can look at it as actually the environment doesn't accommodate the full range of human diversity that we see. Actually, we should be building ramps as well as stairs so that everyone can get into buildings and the problem isn't my body. It's the way that we've constructed this world in which we live. And that's the social model.
There are laws, legislation in place designed to even the playing field, so to speak. How is that not working? And something I noticed, I don't know if it's a fatuous thing to say, but when my son was in a pram, I became very aware of how moving around London is really difficult for people using prams, but also more pertinently, wheelchair users.
Absolutely. And it's so funny. A lot of the times when I do talk to people about this, the way that they feel able to enter the conversation is as a parent who had a pram or as a person who had maybe a sports injury and was on crutches for a while. And that can be kind of an entry into this thing that, as you say, is often invisible.
And I don't mean to be patronizing saying that. It's just something that opened my eyes a bit.
I think that's very fair. And what you're referring to is what I kind of call the disability law implementation gap, which is that we have these beautiful standards that say, you know, whether it's in the Equality Act or the Americans with Disabilities Act or any other number of laws that basically every country in the world has, they say things like disabled people have the right to equal access to space, to education, to every aspect of our society, but you don't see that reflected. You know, here in London where I live, I still go to Soho and can't access what feels like a third of the pavements. So you have these beautiful laws that unfortunately often only exist on paper. They're relegated to words on a page rather than being implemented. And I kind of approach this as a wheelchair user most often through physical space. But disability is a really broad community. It's not just wheelchair users. It's also people who are deaf or blind or autistic or have psychosocial disabilities. And we need to look at this broadly to see how we're including or not including everyone.
Do we have a sense then, Anna, in the British context of the scale of the gap between the legislative intent and the reality?
We don't. And that's one of the biggest problems and something that in my PhD I'm trying to collect data on. Because I think too often people assume, oh, we made the law, we're done. And that's not what happens. This lack of monitoring and evaluation, this lack of enforcement is what causes this gap. And I think a lot of it has to do with kind of culture and attitudes of people knowing that no one's coming to check on whether the law is being followed. And, you know, there's this famous story of a post office in a Latin American country that's now escaping me. And these researchers came to the post office and they said, you have steps on the front. You're supposed to be following the law and put a ramp on there. And he goes, oh, well, why would I do that? Disabled people don't come here. And it's like, well, of course, the disabled people aren't coming here. They can't get into the damn post office. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done around changing culture and awareness, as well as kind of this policy, the regulation of these laws to make them real in order to get to the world we want to have.
I think Jeff may have described you at the beginning as an activist for disability justice. Talk to us about what that means and also maybe how it's changed over time to intersect with tackling other forms of injustice.
Absolutely. So the disability justice movement emerged in the early 2000s amid disability activists in the U.S., who kind of looked at this earlier movement called the Disability Rights Movement and saw some shortcomings with it. Most notably, that it was pretty homogenous, largely made up of white men with physical disabilities who were pretty affluent, and that only reflected kind of one part of this community. And additionally, they looked at what the Disability Rights Movement tried to do, which was pass laws. Give people rights. And they said, the law is not enough. You know, laws are necessary, but they'll never be sufficient to get rid of prejudice. You'll never legislate prejudice out of existence. So what we have to do is what I kind of nickname culture work, changing attitudes, talking to people, finding ways of making the law real that might still have to do with policy. It's also, you know, making it easier for disabled people to be in leadership positions. Because so often this inaccessibility, this inequality is cyclical. You know, disabled people are isolated. We're forced to stay at home because we can't get around properly, whether that's physically, communicationally. And that makes us invisible, which makes society not designed for us. So it's this cycle of inaccessibility in its many forms. And disability justice looks at the ways in which we really have to go beyond legislation in order to change that.
And what are some of the campaigns, when you think back on your own activism, what are some of the campaigns that perhaps you're the proudest to be a part of?
I work with an organization called the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, which essentially we are trying to address the ways that disabled people are left behind in an emergency situation. And we're often treated as kind of expected and acceptable losses. As you know, those people just aren't going to make it. They're not going to survive the fire, the hurricane, the war. And so it's really not even worth including them in the plans for, say, its evacuation or whatever it might be. And so most recently, amid the war in Ukraine, I've been working with a Ukrainian DPO called Fight for Right. DPO is a disabled persons organization to evacuate Ukrainians with disabilities being left behind. And that's been an amazing experience, a really, really difficult one. But we found that, again, all these lofty humanitarian standards about rescuing the most vulnerable and centering those most in need were just not being carried out on the ground. So thus far, we have aided over 5,000 people with disabilities and their loved ones, which is more than I think we ever expected being able to do.
Now, one of the main ways in which we see disabled people represented is through sort of inspirational stories of overcoming adversity. Is that a wholly good thing or not?
It's complicated. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's, I think, framed in a way that does more harm than good. we nickname that sort of thing inspiration porn.
Okay.
Which is essentially this story of, oh, this lovely, inspirational disabled person. Look at them overcoming these challenges. Oh, their life must be so sad, but they're still at the grocery store buying eggs. Give them a pat on the head. And it's so, I think, condescending, paternalistic, and it ignores the ways in which, you know, disabled people do face very real oppression, and we do have to do some very real work to achieve the things that a lot of people take for granted. But by treating us as inspirational and encouraging us to overcome, you're ignoring those barriers that actually we should be eliminating. So those inspirational stories, I think, too often take for granted that it's wrong that these basic things require overcoming.
Where do you find hope and optimism about the future of the disability justice movement?
Yeah, there's so much hope. I look at the amazing other disabled people working in this space, both in the UK and worldwide. And it's just, there's so much potential and things are changing. They're changing slowly because we're up against a whole lot, but they are. The way I got in touch with the podcast was through the Shaw Trust Disability Power 100, which is an annual list of the 100 most influential disabled people in the UK. And being at that event, you know, I couldn't help but be optimistic. Standing in a room with 99 other fantastic disabled leaders who are, you know, working across disciplines in whether it's sports or whether it's technology or education to just push our people forward. So there's a lot to be optimistic about.
Anna, is there anywhere in particular that is a world leader on this?
Well, the classic answer is that the US and the UK have really robust laws. But I think too often these two countries pretend to have the monopoly on disability rights, and that's not quite the case. For example, Argentina really interestingly passed what is a very similar law to the ADA in 1981, so almost a decade before the ADA, ahead of the US. Quite strangely, it was under Argentina's dictatorship. And the tentative story on that, we don't quite know why for sure, is that there were family members of people quite high up in the dictatorship who had contracted polio and were wheelchair users. So you see this really interesting link with a lot of laws across the world on disability, and it depends on the family relationships. It depends on, do you know a disabled person? Are you seeing disabled people around? Which goes back to what we were talking about with that issue of visibility.
So on the podcast, we have something called the Jeffocracy, which is Jeff as the benign ruler. So he claims, if you were chosen by Jeff to be the Minister for Disabled People, I don't know what the title, whether that's the title you'd want, but what title would you want and what would you want to do?
Well, the running joke in the disability community, and I'm telling you a secret here, is that what you guys call the Minister for Disabled People, we call the Minister Against Disabled People. So I would love to help change that. Sure, you can make me Minister for Disabled People. First of all, I would move, if I could, the Minister for Disabled People out of the Department for Work and Pensions, because too often that role has just been focused on what's called the Access to Work program, getting disabled people into employment. And when you look at the grand spread of issues that disabled people have, certainly employment is one of them. But how am I going to have a job if I can't access accessible housing, if I can't go on the pavement to get to my work, if the bus and the tube lifts are broken when I try to go there? So we just need a much more holistic look at disability. And with that position being in DWP, you don't have that. And we just need to get disabled people into all the positions that work under that minister. I could be wrong, but as far as I know, there has never been a disabled person as the Minister for Disabled People. And so you see that they often have no idea what they're doing. We just need people who are living it if you want to actually solve these problems.
That's pretty compelling. It sounds pretty compelling to me, Jeff. I'd say Anna's got the job, hasn't she?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I don't know if I want the job, but thank you.
Anna Landreth, thank you so much for joining us and for being part of this conversation.
Thank you, guys. It was lovely meeting you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Small details or big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
With me now is novelist, editor, playwright, and author of a fantastic new book called Every Cripple, a Superhero, Christoph Keller. Hello.
Hi. Very nice to be on your show.
It's great to have you. I really enjoyed the book. I'd not come across your writing before. The book is a memoir. I mean, it's that slightly oversimplifies it because it flits between memoir and verse and story. But it tells your story of living with spinal muscular atrophy type 3.
It's a rare but not all too rare disability. It's genetic. It affects your involuntary muscles. So, I mean, my arms, my legs, I'm in a wheelchair. I can't walk anymore. I can't even stand anymore. And it's progressive. So that means I was born with it, even though we didn't know that. But then after a while, a very, very slow progression set in.
What's so interesting and what you get at so well with the condition being progressive is how disability can affect relationships over time.
I always thought that disability is, in a sense, it's a good friend chooser. You instantly develop an antenna of how people react to your disability. So that hurts, but I learned to kind of accept that as, I mean, since my book is called Every Cripple a Superhero, I learned to accept that as a superpower. I kind of have the ability to detect that. And I certainly got lucky when I came across my wife, who is so unbelievable in dealing with what I have, which is not easy because it's progressive. There are always other versions of me. Every once in a while, the disability progresses and there are things I can't do anymore and we have to deal with that.
You write that people were surprised that your earlier books, your earlier writing, weren't about your thing.
Like you said, when my first book came out, they said, well, of course he's writing about his disability. So I said, no, I'm not. I was a writer, period. And then after a few novels and books, I don't know, it was one of my 7th or 8th book, I decided, with the help of my wife, Jan, isn't it time to write about something that doesn't make you, but it's not that it's not part of you. And that was a really great and painful experience because to then really honestly write about such a tough thing that really concerns you is brutal, but it was also cathartic. I'm talking about the book The Best Dancer, not the Every Cripple Superhero, you know, the prequel, if you will. But for then the sequel, I thought I don't want to use a memoir kind of narrative. It's a modern form. This book is so rich and it's so wonderfully hybrid with all the mini essays, a little playlet, the radio play, aphorisms, poems. And it sort of makes it hybrid, I think makes it also wonderful to read.
And another way in which you break form, you use photography. Tell us about that decision.
The initial idea was I was upset with all the broken curb cuts. So many everywhere from completely unusable to simply dangerous. So I rolled around and took pictures of the broken curb cuts. And the idea was to send them to the city and say, well, you got to fix these. But then what happened is when I went back to the computer and looked at all those pictures, they were so gorgeous. They were mainly reflections that created gorgeous distortions. So I realized these are portals to another New York City, a magical, beautiful, mysterious, unexpected town. They have to be in the book.
Something I wanted to ask you about is you're living in Switzerland again now. You spent a lot of time in New York. You've obviously traveled the world. What have you learned about the ways in which different societies disable people?
The Swiss way to deal with the disabilities, I basically grew up being ashamed of my condition. Nobody talked about it, including in the family. That's just the way it is. Don't demand anything. Wait till it's given for you freely and then be very grateful. Say thank you, thank you, thank you. And I unlearned that in New York. New York is special. I just very soon I felt, you know what? Everybody's a freak here. So I can be a freak. What they do is they say, oh, my God, you have such cool glasses. Love your hat, or even, hey, love your shiny wheels. And someone looks at me and doesn't just see the people with a disability, but a man with a potential, whatever that potential could be. But I still feel in Switzerland there's a huge last obstacle, and that is that we are not meant to be in positions of power where we can decide about our own lives. I don't know whether that's fully true in New York, but I think when you think of the activism in the US, it's so much more powerful. I mean, the disability, we are 20%. That's the rough estimate. You know, we really need more representation. And that's what I want to fight for. And not just one, but many.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about this, because I'd have thought that the European experience might be better than the one in the States, just by virtue of the fact that we have safety nets here in Europe to a far greater extent, mm-hmm. in terms of things like healthcare and social care.
All these welfare things are, of course, great. And in that respect, the US is a very brutal society. Here we have an insurance which is unfortunately called invalid insurance. It's very telling what the country still thinks of people who need that kind of assistance. But that got us pretty high up. They pay a lot. So when you have a disability here, you don't end up on the street. In the US, you could. So that's obviously better. But people basically think, but they have that insurance. They're being taken care of, and now they want to see it in Congress. I mean, is it ever enough? In a strange way, a mostly good institution becomes also an obstacle. When I compare the two countries, I often go back to the ADA, the American with Disabilities Act. Yeah, that came in 1990 and had a very powerful tool, which was the right to sue. In this case, it was a good thing. Of course, they were all afraid that it's going to be waves and waves of lawsuits, but it was actually modest given what the US is like. But what it did is, like, overnight, and by overnight, I mean 2-3 years, it changed the country. It made it so much more accessible. And in Switzerland, we came 14 years later with that law, but without the right to sue. So that brings me back to that the disabled have to be ashamed, et cetera, et cetera. They have to wait till it's given to them. That's the exact same thing. No tool to actually get your thing through. So that is a big, big difference.
How optimistic do you feel about things moving towards societies that embrace difference?
be it a physical disability, be it neurodiversity, that human beings just aren't all built the same way. So societies shouldn't be built for the people in the middle of the bell curve.
I'm actually optimistic. I do think we are on the right track. You know, with all the discussions about gender, ethnic, political correctness, and yes, it does get on my nerves sometimes. There's so much being discussed, but I think that pushes it all in the right direction, you know. One problem I have with that is actually that sometimes all these discussions actually crush the discussions about disability, because it seems to me there can be a group of wonderful variety, diversity, but no disability. As delicate as that may be, for God's sake, include disability, and then it would be even more diverse.
Well, we're great believers in the power of empathy on this podcast, and I think when people are able to hear the stories and experiences of other people, it can change attitudes, change perspectives. And the book does a fantastic job of that. It's called Every Cripple a Superhero. Christoph Keller, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Now, the People's History Museum in Manchester is currently staging a landmark exhibition about the fight for disabled people's rights. It's called Nothing About Us Without Us. And with us now is community curator Ruth Malkin. Hello.
Hello.
Can you start by telling us a bit about the exhibition and the idea behind it?
Well, as you say, it's about the struggle that disabled people have had of getting what everybody else takes for granted, which can be summarised quite nicely by one of the sections of the exhibition, actually, to boldly go where everyone has gone before, which is a slogan from the Disabled People's Direct Action Network that was active in the 1990s, trying to get disabled people access to public transport. Disabled people have had centuries of other people deciding what their lives should be like. And we have struggled against that for years. And that's why it's called Nothing About Us Without Us, because we feel we are the best place to make decisions about our own lives. And this exhibition celebrates the struggle to achieve that.
Now, you're a community curator, Ruth. Could you tell us what that is and what that's been like for you?
There's a team of us. So I'm a community co-curator. There have been four of us working on this exhibition, but also there's a steering group of disabled people behind us who have been instrumental in making the decisions about the exhibition. And the museum has acted as a facilitator. They have offered their space and their expertise, but it has been led by disabled people, for everybody, but for disabled people particularly, to show what our lives are like and what they could be like. So it's disabled people past, present and future.
And how did you personally get involved?
I have been involved in the disability rights movement and disability arts for many, many years. I was a member of the Disabled People's Direct Action Network, and I was one of the people who visited the museum, actually, and there was a board about disability rights that wasn't quite right there. And I remember going away thinking, oh, I should challenge that. Well, some disabled people that I happen to know did challenge that. One person in particular on the steering group said, I think you'd be ideal for this. And I thought, well, I'll apply for it. And I did. And I was very lucky to be one of the four that were chosen.
We've been talking about the social model of disability on the podcast today. How's that idea informed the disability rights movement? And how is that part of your exhibition?
The social model of disability takes the focus off the individual and the individual defect as it is seen generally in society, and puts the emphasis on removing the disabling barriers. And it comes about actually from somebody called Vic Finkelstein, who was the apartheid activist in South Africa, and he was a wheelchair user. And he was the one who came up with this idea of what is it that disables me? and that was picked up in this country and taken on by sociologists. And it had informed our entire exhibition.
So we just talked to Anna quite a lot about mobility. Maybe you could talk about some of the other ways in which this specific exhibition has been made accessible.
They've done as much as they can do at the museum to try and remove the barriers for as many people as possible. So the museum itself is physically accessible, but there's also a quiet space. So if you feel a bit overwhelmed by the crowds of people, you can go and sit in a quiet space. So all the objects are audio described. Every single label has been interpreted into British Sign Language. And this is accessed through a QR code. So if you haven't got your smartphone, you can borrow a tablet from the museum and someone will show you how to access the audio description, the subtitles and the British Sign Language. Audio described tours are going to take place and sign language tours are going to take place as well. There are one or two other adjustments we've made, but we've tried to cover everything that we can think of. But we know that access is an ever-changing thing. So if you feel that your needs haven't been met, then come and talk to us. Let us know about that, what your needs are, and we will try and meet them.
And what's the reaction to the exhibition been like?
It's been overwhelming, really. At the moment, a lot of people who've seen the exhibition so far have been people who've been on the journey with us, or people who know about the journey that we've been on. People have just been absolutely overwhelmed by it. For me personally, and the feedback I've got from other disabled people was, I never thought I would see an exhibition about my experiences and my struggle for human rights. And here it is. And that's what people have been saying. They've been saying, we never thought we would see our lives actually commemorated in this way.
And for able-bodied people who go around the exhibition, is there a particular thing that you would like them to take out of it?
I would like them to go away thinking that the battle isn't won. And I would like them people to realise that we are all in this together, because disability can happen to any of us at any point. A lot of people think disability doesn't affect me, but it does. The disabling barriers affect everyone in our society, and if we remove them effectively, then we could function as a society much better. And I would also just like to say, sorry to say this, Ed, I would also like to say that I hope that people will go away from the exhibition knowing that there's no such thing as able-bodied.
Yeah, I was actually wondering about my use of the term, or whether it was the wrong term to use.
Is non-disabled the correct?
Non-disabled. There's no such thing as able-bodied. People are disabled or non-disabled in terms of the social model of disability.
Ruth, very early on when you were telling us how this exhibition came to be, you were talking about being at the People's History Museum, seeing an early version of this and thinking, I must challenge that. Is it your hope that within your lifetime or beyond, that disabled people won't have to kind of go through life thinking, oh, I have to challenge that? Do you feel optimistic about that?
I think everyone has to challenge everything all the time. Society is forever questioning, and I think that that is a healthy thing that we should be driving forward, all of us. Society is dynamic, and there will always be the need to challenge the status quo. That is not something that should be considered to be a negative thing. That just helps our society to flourish.
Now, Ruth, sometimes we blame the issues that disabled people face on the ways our society was set up 50 or 100 years ago, but new issues continue to emerge, don't they? Can you talk to us about the ways in which new technology causes barriers to disabled people?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of ways that new technology is adapted without actually thinking about how disabled people are going to use it. A pet hate of mine is touchscreen. We have everywhere, we've got touchscreen technology, and it's just not suitable for lots and lots of people for lots and lots of reasons. How do you touch a screen if you can't see it? I have dyspraxia, So any of these things where you have to press something and hold or remain still for any people with Parkinson's, etc., or cerebral palsy, that situation is worse. Moving away from museums, I work with the NHS to try and get them to understand that the way they do, say, mammograms isn't accessible to wheelchair users. Isn't accessible to quite a number of disabled people, actually. Not everyone can sort of hop on a bed and lie down and remain still, but we're forever being asked to do these things. So that way, all these advances have taken place without actually thinking, what is the makeup of the population and how can we make it inclusive of everybody? So, and I have a tremendous problem, for example, with headphones. I can't necessarily always use headphones. I wear hearing aids. I need headphones to be compatible with hearing aids. They're not always compatible. So it's about not thinking, oh, we've got the magic bullet that meets everybody's needs and we're just going to provide that one thing. It's about providing a whole range of options. And I think that that's what we've tried to do in the museum. We've tried to provide information in the whole range of options so that people can choose the best option for themselves.
And when does the exhibition run until, Ruth?
It runs until the 15th of October 2023, and we will be doing special days linked to different celebration weeks. So for example, British Sign Language Week, we will be doing special tours, etc., about the exhibition to focus on the deaf people that have been celebrated in the exhibition.
Well, it sounds brilliant. I really do want to come and see it. The exhibition is called Nothing About Us Without Us. It's at the People's History Museum in Manchester. Community co-curator Ruth Malkin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
I want to talk about something.
Go on.
It's the Cheerful Theme Tune Contest.
I mean, it's gripping the nation.
I think it's important to be honest with the listeners. I would say that...
Why break the habit of 5 years?
I would say that the engagement hasn't perhaps been what I would have hoped.
It's been high quality.
I think it makes the Festival of Brexit look like a runaway success. I don't know if it's that our audience aren't a musical audience or they're just too busy for fripperies like this. People have lives going on. But we've basically ended up in a situation where we have two entries. So it's very much like a Tory leadership race or awarding a rail franchise.
No, I think we've whittled it down. Let's just be clear.
Well, I think the audience have whittled it down.
Yes, in a way.
By not entering.
But I did think this was decided in my absence. I mean, I don't want to point fingers here, this idea. I did think it was quite high, as we economists would say, high barriers to entry. To design a whole jingle for a podcast, it's quite a big ask. It's not like, you know...
Look, I don't want to point fingers at our listenership. I just want to say, a while ago on my other podcast, which has far fewer listeners than this one, we had a temporary running feature about mugs. And I asked those listeners to send in jingles. We were inundated.
Ooh. Mugs. What's it got to do with mugs?
We found ourselves having a number of interesting conversations about mugs.
I mean, obviously, I listen every week.
Of course, Do you have a mug that you favour?
Not really, no.
That in itself is quite interesting, I think, because a lot of people do.
What do you think of this one? Is this Garfield?
Let's have a look. It looks maybe like some kind of counterfeit Garfield. Right. But anyway, let's leave the mugs aside for a second. So I'm thinking, because our Reasons to be Cheerful audience, of course they're talented, of course they're musical, but they are busy people and don't have time for fripperies. That's what I'm putting this down to.
Of course,
But basically the situation we find ourselves in is that the two people we had enter a while back have come back with revised entries based on the notes that we gave on their initial efforts.
I mean, it's a bit like Rishi Sunak standing for the Tory leadership for a second time, isn't it?
Can I tell you my concern here?
That we've got a Liz Truss entry, no.
Well, there's that. if we'd had a lot of entries, I wouldn't feel bad for the people that didn't win.
However, what I want you to do is imagine some kind of contest where theoretically any number of people could win, but really it's just a straight choice between two people. I'm worried that there could be some kind of long-term psychological effect on the person who doesn't win, who is in effect rejected by the, let's call them the electorate.
Do you think we should be having this conversation on the podcast?
Yes, I think we should be open.
I think it's a bit too open, actually.
Too much transparency.
Yeah. Should we hear the entries?
Yes.
We think they're great entries.
They are great entries. They are great. But
they're the pick of the bunch.
Yes, they literally are. The first revised effort comes from John Walton, who says, I hope I find you well and good. Please find attached my submission for the cheerful theme tune. So are we ready for John's redo?
Yep. Reasons to be cheerful.
Reasons to be cheerful. Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Reasons to be cheerful.
Okay. I feel that John has really upped his game there.
I like it.
It's catchy.
Yeah.
It's in my head already.
Yeah. Boo, 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 doo, doo, doo. Reasons to be cheerful.
Yeah.
Reasons to be cheerful.
You'll be trying to get to sleep tonight and that'll be going round and round in your head.
Be cheerful. It's got a real je ne sais quoi.
Maybe je sais quoi.
Or Je m'appelle Jeff.
I'm impressed at John's ability to take a note. I think he's upped his game. That is catchy. It ticks all the boxes that Dan McGrath, who wrote the Strictly theme tune, gave us in terms of what a signature tune could be. I think that is very strong.
Next.
Now, next. The other redo comes from Jonah Carswell, who says, Hi, Ed and Jeff and Rachel. I hope you're well. I heard Jeff's feedback regarding my song on this week's podcast, and all I can say is you're absolutely right. You were searching for a pair of metaphorical tailored trousers, and I simply grabbed an old pair out of my, again, metaphorical cupboard. This week, I took some time to think about whether or not I want to be the type of person who goes around thrusting pairs of metaphorical second-hand trousers in people's faces, and I've come to the conclusion that this is not who I want to be anymore. So therefore, as a symbol of deepest regret, I've metaphorically sewn an entirely bespoke pair of metaphorical trousers for you. I've attached these trousers to this email, and I hope that this can at least go part of the way towards making amends for my despicable actions last week. I now feel harsh for saying the whole thing about the bespoke trousers.
Yeah, I do. I think you are. Right, let's play it.
I think that there's an embarrassment of riches in this one.
There really is.
There's so much going on.
It's like Bohemian Rhapsody.
It is. I almost feel like if we were going to release a Reasons to be Cheerful novelty single, that would be it.
Yeah.
With you and me clowning around in the video.
I don't think it would do that well. It's got all these sort of weird words in there about we're bringing you good news, shine a light, this, that and the other.
Come on, where's your sense of poetry, Ed?
I think
is
I prefer
that not
the first
what we're
one.
Doing?
I think I preferred the first one, actually.
Do you know what I'm starting to think now?
Go on.
Do you remember Only Fools and Horses had one theme music at the beginning and one theme music at the end?
Wow.
Maybe that's what we do here. We use one for the front of the podcast and one for the back of the podcast.
I mean, I would say organise a vote, but only three people will take part.
What if people spoiled their ballots?
So you could vote for Ed Seed.
We did impose a Christmas deadline on this, didn't we?
Christmas when?
Actually, did I say?
Look, I think it's just hard to, honestly, it's hard to break the tie. It's like comparing apples and pears, beautiful apples and sweet pears.
I prefer an apple to a pear.
I quite like a good pear.
Really?
Yeah.
The texture? You're fine with the texture?
No,
like you, as somebody who's always picking things out of the teeth at the best of times, how'd you get on with the pair?
Well, that's a very personal comment.
Well, a lot of people wouldn't be doing it in mixed company.
Right. I mean, I think we're moving on. I don't know why an apple is less likely to get stuck in your teeth than a pear. I don't really buy that.
That's sort of like furry texture. It's a bit squidgier.
You're being very Larry David here. Okay. Yeah. What are we going to do? I think, to be honest, it's the Pottery Barn principle. You broke it, you own it. You caused this dilemma for us. You're going to have to resolve it. If you really want to take big decisions in the Jeffocracy, you're going to have to decide, mate.
All right. Well, stay tuned for the next thrilling installment of what we're going to do about this hole that I appear to have dug here, this dead end that I've taken us down.
Yep. We really would encourage you to email in. You've still got time to email on the music competition until Christmas.
2028.
But you've also got... but we also want to hear your views on future episodes or this episode, and you find us at cheerfulpodcast.com.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
Whoa-ho-ho.
We're in the outro, and this is our last outro before Advent. As of next week, we'll be lighting candles every week, won't we? Are you not excited about the Advent calendar?
Well, I don't want to be bar humbug about this.
You know, Rachel, really? Our producer, is in a choir that's performing songs from the film Love Actually in a couple of weeks. Wow. But she says it's completely sold out, so we can't go. Now, I don't know if she's just saying that so that we don't turn up.
If I'd said that to you, you'd have been quite mortally offended, actually.
I'd want guest list places.
Maybe it's like a double-double... triple double. That maybe what she thinks is she doesn't want to put pressure on us to come, so she's telling us it's sold out in order to relieve us of the burden. Or maybe she's just like a bit embarrassed by us.
I think that's more likely. We could always just turn up and see if there are any touts outside, any scalpers.
We could go in false beards.
Do false beards allow you entry? We could go disguised as choristers. What if we were disguised as choristers?
A disguise.
We still don't have tickets, though.
Or pantomime halls?
Who would turn away that pantomime horse?
I mean, that would be a sort of an extreme way to gate crash the thing. Look, I'm sorry, with a pantomime horse, which was in part of Love Actually, it was in the bonus bit on the DVD, and we're required. I think that's actually quite a genius idea.
Yeah, we've got it. We're here for the manger scene.
It's a pantomime horse in the manger scene. I don't think that's quite right. But anyway,
Maybe we'd be a donkey. We'd be a pantomime donkey. I'm quite sure.
I think we need to go. I think we need to sort of reference back to Love Actually. We need to see what potential gate crashing animal we could be.
I mean, there was a prime minister in Love Actually.
I don't think either of us qualify for that. Right. Boom, boom. Should we thank our guests?
We should. Thank you to Anna Landra, to Christoph Keller, and to Ruth Malkin. The aforementioned Rachel Barmer is our content producer. Thank you to Rachel for sorting out all the guests and research.
Good luck with the show to which we're not invited.
I know. We're going to figure out how to get in there. I think this pantomime horse is a goer.
I know. And there you are, like, sceptical about my ideas.
I've lost confidence in my own ideas after the cheerful tune contest. Emma Corsham is our audio producer. Flip the order there this week because we were just talking about Rachel. Rachel, by the way, is supported by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music.
For now.
James Deacon made our idents.
For now.
And our artwork was designed by...
Henry Cull. Maybe we should have an idents competition.
Just leave it.
He's been Jeff Lloyd, full of good ideas.
He's been the other end of a pantomime horse.
And these have been...
Reasons to be cheerful.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.